Okay, my name is Daniel Schur. I'm the Associate Director of the Innovations for Successful Societies project, and I'm here with Mr. Raphael Trotman in Georgetown, Guyana, on the 16th of May 2009. Mr. Trotman, thank you very much taking time to meet me.
I know, of course,
you've already met with my colleague Rania,
yes, and
she will have covered a lot of the initial background questions and that type of thing. So, with your permission, I thought we could just dive straight into the issues of security sector reform in the environment. Could you just quickly tell us what your involvement with security sector reform is and your position as it relates to observing and commentating on this process?
Okay, well, let me say that I've been, since becoming active in politics, I have always had some responsibility for security issues. As early as 1994, I was an elected member of the Georgetown City Council and became the chairman of the City Council's Legal and Security Affairs Committee. That, of course, was at a very micro level, dealing with security matters for the city, but at the same time, as they were coordinated with the police and with government. Thereafter, I was elected to Parliament in 1997 and took on, or was assigned, the responsibility of spokesperson for the main opposition party. That would be the People's National Congress Reform. I was spokesperson for all matters dealing with national security and foreign relations whenever they came up in Parliament. That therefore allowed me to interface with many of the local and foreign stakeholders and players in the sector. In thereafter, in 2000 particularly, I was invited to undertake study at the Center for Hemispheric Defense Studies in the United States of America. That is, I believe, a department of the National Defense University in Washington. I spent 3 weeks there with several senior ranking police and military officers from Guyana, as well as with other civilians. Apart from that, I do have a master's degree in international relations, but with an emphasis on security, from Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, where my work and thesis really was on the threat of state failure in the Caribbean from violence, both criminal and political. That really opened my eyes to what was happening in and around Guyana. In 2001, I was named as a member of a bipartisan committee known as the Border National Security Committee. That committee was bipartisan, government and opposition. It was chaired by the Speaker of the National Assembly, Ralph Ramparan, co-chaired, there were co-chairs, and former Brigadier General David Granger. So that again gave me great insight into what was happening. Thereafter, I've continued to be very much involved in different aspects of the policy formulation. I have met with many of the teams that have come to Guyana to review and to advise the government, particularly those that were sponsored by the British government, and of course those that from time to time come from the US and Canada. I continue in Parliament to speak on the issue. And I'm a member of the Disciplined Forces, a special select committee that is reviewing the Disciplined Forces Commission report. I'm a member of Special Select Committee in Parliament that reviews the implementation of the Security Sector Reform Action Plan, which is a British government sponsored program. And I'm a member of the Standing Committee on National Security, which committee has not been meeting, but nonetheless I'm still a member of it. I should go back to say that whilst I was a member of the main opposition party, I was the team leader for all aspects of the PNC's presentation to the Disciplined Forces Commission. So I was the lead presenter on behalf of the party, and I, as I said, had the responsibility of preparing and presenting the PNC's position to that commission. I suppose that there are a few other lesser known things that I've been involved in, but I've continued, as I said, to interface with members of the security sector in Guyana.
Well, with your involvement in these various activities, you've really been in the front row seat to see the sort of evolving challenges that the security sector is facing.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the challenges that the GPF in particular is facing today and how these have evolved over time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, undoubtedly the challenges have changed within the last decade, and many of them, I believe, are a result of the socio-political issues that have also come up. And what we found is crime taking on a more violent face and posture, and coming particularly from what in Ghana we refer to as depressed communities, many of them predominantly African populated communities. And so it is my belief that these communities are spawning criminals whose intent is not necessarily to enrich themselves. That may be their principal objective, but certainly secondary to that is, secondary to that there is that these criminals are also desirous of making a political statement, that they are being forgotten, ignored, overlooked, discriminated against, and in many respects brutalized. And so they feel that they need to arm themselves. And in doing so, they bring recognition to themselves, respect, and some degree of honor in that world, that is. So the gun has become a very, in their hands, the gun has become a useful tool that not only provides food, but also provides respect. And the government is seen in Guyana by many to be oppressive. And this is their way of gaining respect. I should add as well that I feel that in the eyes of many like them, the political process has failed. That is, voting for a political party, going through the motions of being registered, lining up on the day of elections, voting, and awaiting the results, through the various cycles of elections, these have not brought the relief that they expected. And that is why I'm saying that there's a socio-political and maybe a socio-economic aspect to many of the crimes we're seeing. There is, of course, the heavy influence of the drug trade. In no way am I trying to discount or disregard the involvement of the drug trade in Guyana. And by now, you will be aware of names like Roger Khan, Sean Hines, and others. When we started to witness in Guyana mysterious deaths, where persons or bodies would turn up sometimes one or two a day, every day, with multiple gunshot wounds. And it was at a press conference hosted by Dr. Roger Luncheon, who is the cabinet secretary. And I'm going to try to quote his words. This would have been sometime in 2003 or 4. When he says, and I quote him, that there's reasonable, plausible evidence that there is a phantom group involved in extrajudicial killings. And these killings are not the work of the security forces. Words to that effect. Thereafter, the whole, he in a sense, knowingly or unknowingly, gave, anointed or named the group, the Phantom Group. That's where the name came from, the Phantom. They operated like an unseen force. And I believe the evidence is clear that they were linked to the government. Roger Khan's own words, he had taken out full-page advertisements in the daily newspapers speaking about or speaking to his involvement. And he did brief, though the meeting is denied, but I don't think that there's much of an effort to do so, but he did brief senior officials of the U.S. Embassy here about his role and involvement at the time. So what we have is crime that has certainly evolved, that like I said, is partly linked to the drug trade and partly linked to the socio-political tension and what I would call sometimes the socio-political, there's a Cold War. And there was a period of time when on the former Minister of Home Affairs, Ronald Gadraj. And as you know, the Home Affairs Minister is really the subject minister for national security. In answer to a question put by me in the National Assembly, it was revealed that on an annual basis, over a four-year period, over 3,000 plus firearm licenses were issued by the government. That, for a population of less than a million, is a staggering amount of guns to put into the hands of citizens. I believe that the government may have had a policy of arming the citizens to protect them from threats. But at the same time, it sent the message that the police force was inept and incapable. At the same time, looking at it from the other side of the coin, those who were not privileged to obtain these firearm licenses, I believe at some point in time decided that if one group was armed officially, they needed to be armed unofficially. Because the perception was that it was supporters of the government who were being given these permits to bear arms. And so accessing firearms became the quest, I believe, of most of the youth. Because it was felt that the state had become oppressive. The state was arming its supporters, and the state was sanctioning a death squad. And that there was no recourse or redress to be had from the Guyana police force, the military, the judiciary, or the opposition parties in Guyana. The system had failed them. So what we have are a proliferation of guns, small arms, and by extension a proliferation of the crimes being committed by or crimes involving the use of firearms. There is a belief as well that as a society we have become brutish. And I'm not being a sociologist, I really can't say when and why it happened, but there is a perception, very widespread and pervasive, that the judicial system is not working. It has failed. And therefore, the recourse to the courts for settlement of disputes is down. There is also the belief, very pervasive as well, that the police force is corrupt. And in the sense that anyone who commits a crime, if he or she has money,
can be excused from that crime. And on the other hand, and this is particularly the level of the working class of all races, that the police force is incapable of protecting them. So there are a lot of instances of people settling disputes violently, And there's also, I believe, a lot of the use of firearms in disputes, because there's a sense that British within the perpetrators believe that they will walk, that they will not be successfully prosecuted. Either because the system is too weak, they're just another statistic in it and it will go away. And some who are connected could have it go away, but others are prepared to take the chances, knowing that the system will not get around to them. You can wait a number of years for a trial and you'll be okay. So the rate of successful prosecution by the police is very low. I don't have a percentage to give you or a statistic, but I know that it is low. And people, I believe, are capitalizing on that. That said, however, I believe that the police force has done a good job at maintaining the peace in the face of all these underlying tensions within the society, many of which have nothing to do with simple crime and security. There are an overlap of, as I say, socio-political issues, economic issues, and things like that. And so I believe that it's perhaps sometimes a miracle that this country has not exploded and gotten to a state where we are like Somalia or somewhere like that, where, you know, armed gangs and warlords rule the roost. And so the police force needs, I believe, all the assistance it can get. I am always concerned about the government's relationship with the police force. I believe that the government, I try to understand, I believe that the government sees itself as being under siege and has therefore organized both the military and the police force to meet that threat. Rumors of coup d'etats and after the Lusignan and Bataka massacres of a potential insurgency, certainly, I believe, drove the government to take more hardline positions, which have had the corresponding effect of alienating the people from the police, from the security forces, which is something, as you know, that insurgents deliberately do. But it has had the effect of alienating or further fracturing the relationship between police and the people. And so it is quite a common sight to see heavily armed police ranks driving around the city 24 hours a day, armed with heavy weapons, which... So there's always the image of strength, and that creates a cloud or a pall of fear in the society. These open back pickups with armed ranks doing normal, regular patrols on a daily basis, all year, is the way that the government has sought to manage the problem. And the truth is, the government's reaction is quite predictable. and understandable from a theoretical point of view, because any government feeling threatened is likely to behave and to act out in that manner. And what has happened in a sense is that there's more of a focus on the operational side of the security. On the operational side than there is on things like building trust, doing or commissioning or sponsoring research studies, on what is really happening within pockets of our society, so that you could meet these challenges and these new threats. Some of it is being done, but not at the rate at which should be done. Really spending more on intelligence gathering, and being able to respond in advance rather than after, in a brutal manner. You would have heard the president speaking at the opening of the police commissioners' conference, and I believe the doctrine was clearly spelt out at that conference, that we shall meet force with force. That if you take up an AK, we will bring out our AKs against you. Every police force in the world must have units within that can deal with the more vicious criminal. But I believe that somewhere along the way, the doctrine of protecting and serving was replaced by the doctrine that says we will project and use force to manage this society. And so we are caught in a vortex that sees us going through cycles of violence. And there may be prevailing quiet or peace now, but at some time, and I'm not trying to be a soothsayer necessarily, but I think that the readings show that at some time another gang is going to be formed, and that other gang is likely to be more vicious than its predecessors. That is what I feel. And some will disagree with me. That is their right. That is my opinion. So that is my take on what is happening and how the government is responding. We've not had sufficient movement on the security sector reform in all of its components, except perhaps the operational side. The acquisition of material, weaponry, intelligence gathering equipment, vehicles, body armor. Those, I have no doubt, are very much in place. But the other components which needed or need to be developed simultaneously in terms of oversight, parliamentary oversight, civil society involvement, restoring the trust and the relationship, those are not being done. Or at least not at the rate at which they should be done. And this government seems to get into action when there is a crisis. Whenever there's a crisis, there's movement. And when there's calm, perhaps there's a belief that the threat or the threats have either dissipated or have been vanquished, and so we find that we slip away or let go from taking hold of the problem
rather than using the opportunity of the quietude to rush as many of the reforms through, so that if and when other threats emerge, they could be dealt with. I want to say something apart from the vicious crimes.
Okay.
That there is definitely something happening within our society. There is an increase in suicides. Domestic violence. And sexual offenses, to name three that are very, very worrying to me. And they all speak to some serious issues or to some crisis or crises within societies. Again, there is a fixation with the AK-47 bearing criminal. I believe he, and there'll be reports of some women, he or she, are at the apex of this problem. That's not to say that that is the only problem, but something is happening that is leading to a breakdown of moral values, also that is creating a sense of doom and gloom, that people are taking their lives more so. The numbers are up. It happens, and of course suicide is something that will never stop, but the propensity with which people are seeing suicide as a way out of whatever problem, either it's a domestic problem, it's a financial problem, or it's a problem that cannot be resolved by the system, whether it be the healthcare system, the judicial system, or otherwise.
there's a sense that something is wrong, and all these things are feeding into the criminal, I want to call it the criminal mushroom cloud. It's there. It's something happening that that we have to look beyond the manifestation as seen through high profile gun crimes, and look as well at what is spawning them, what is happening within our societies. Is it that all of the government institutions or the state's institutions are failing, that a man could slash his wife's throat and turn on his daughter? That's a case from last week. And the niece, or people can beat up another person so viciously. Why can't you settle this matter in a mature manner, through counseling, through the police, through the courts, through the churches even? Something so these are some of the issues that I think we need to be spending far more time on as policymakers. Regretfully, because the government will be the lead stakeholder in all of these, we cannot, the rest of us can't move faster than the government is prepared to move, or can't move in other directions which the government is not inclined to move into at all or immediately. But as I said, those are some of the matters that concern me.
Okay, this is part two of the interview with Mr. Trotman.
I was saying that I'm giving you my own perspectives. I don't have all the facts or can't connect all of the dots. But these are some of the emerging threats that show that the face of crime is changing and is becoming more perverse. Some of it, of course, is influenced by external forces, transnational crime, the whole issue of drugs and terrorism and all that. We do have as well, of course, like most Caribbean nations, the issue of the deportees coming back to Guyana. Though the last statistics I saw actually showed that deportees were not the primary perpetrators of vicious crimes. Many of them were consumed with finding a way back to where they were deported from. Some have gotten involved in crime. Some have, I have no doubt, given advice. But the statistics really do not show that the average criminal in Ghana is a deportee. We've had Fine Man, we've had... More recently, we've had a youngster named Nasty Man, little 13-year-old who was found with an AK, charged with murder. These are little children, and I should say as well that I've noticed that the average age is between 16 and, say, 21, 22. That's the age that I'm seeing of vicious criminals.
I have a few questions that I'd like to ask based on this. I think the first question is during this period of Roger Khan's involvement with the Phantom Squads, one thing I'd be interested in hearing your opinion on is why the government chose to look outside the police or to work with these very shadowy extrajudicial units doing things in a very illegal manner in a way that could only further undermine the police's credibility. Why not work with the police on this particular issue?
Well, I believe, as I said, that it is the reaction of the government was quite predictable. If one were to examine similar situations in other parts of the world, and I will use Colombia as an example. And government felt threatened by the FARC. They turned to right-wing groups outside of the security forces. Because, of course, there are two reasons. One was distrust of the security forces. A sense that by the government that the security forces were themselves too weak and incapable of responding. And thirdly, that the kind of response that was required would be circumscribed or prevented by law. Bearing in mind that you have human rights groups, opposition parties, and, of course, the international community is looking at you. It therefore, at some point in time, became perhaps at some time they believed that the better option was or would have been to use the underworld. You know that there is a well-known adage that says it takes a terrorist to kill a terrorist. And so I believe that the government felt that to be able to defeat what it considered to be a threat against it, that they needed to become dirty. No government in the world would relish, and I don't believe this government relished the idea, but obviously at some point in time felt sufficiently threatened and overwhelmed that it became sold on the idea that this was how the response should go.
Another question I had relates to the Disciplined Forces report, the Disciplined Forces Commission, and you mentioned that you are sitting on the Special Select Committee that's reviewing that report. Now, my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that the committee has been sitting since 2004 or 2005.
Well, what happened was that, yes, there was committee number one. Mm-hmm. That committee came to an end when Parliament was dissolved and elections were held in 2006 without completing its work. When the ninth Parliament, which is the current Parliament, was convened in September of 2006, there was little or nothing happening there. But as part of the security sector reform program, a necessary component was the reestablishment of a committee to complete the work which had begun. So in a sense, this is committee number two. We have still not finished. We still to do the police force. And
We've done the GDF, the prisons, and the fire service, but not the police force, which in a sense is the biggest part of it all. We're yet to commence that, though it may not be, once we start, it may not be that protracted, because we may more than likely go back to the previous police report or presentation and maybe just update it rather than go into every detail all over again. The previous committee had received, had a presentation made by the police top brass. So we are likely to just reread that presentation, and that will find us, I think, going through that aspect of it far quicker.
I also was wondering if you could comment on the various donor-funded reforms. You have
the various
donor-funded reforms. So you have the IDP, Citizen Security Projects, and the British Security Sector Action Plan. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your perception of how these plans are moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, in terms of the IDB Citizen Security Program, I am not very au fait with it. Mm-hmm. I have read it, but there is a paucity of information coming out from the Ministry of Home Affairs on that, and quite frankly, I suspect that it's not doing very well, because if the government had anything to boast about, it would have been doing so. Not too okay with what's happening there. It is not, there is no oversight component which I'm familiar. There are no press conferences held about how it is progressing or not progressing. There are no reports which are made public that have analyzed the policy to say what is working, what is not. I do know that I've heard the Minister of Home Affairs himself bemoaning the fact that the Crime Stoppers program has more or less failed, that people are not responding. I think that was a major component of that program. In terms of the DFID-led program, I know that that is not moving apace, that there continue to be bottlenecks, particularly at the Office of the President. I think just for the signing of an MOU, I don't think it has been signed, but that program is not moving apace. Certainly not at the rate at which it was designed to move. The Standing Committee in Parliament has never met. The Select Committee to review the implementation of the action plan has never met. When I ask, I'm told that it's because nothing has been sent to Parliament for review. The Prime Minister is the chairman of that committee and has never seen it fit to convene the committee and ask for reports. And because, of course, it's not a committee chaired by the opposition, we are unable to trigger any reviews or to find out what's happening. So there's not much, as far as I'm aware, in terms of movement holistically. There may be some, as I said, the procurement of body armor and vehicles and weaponry and things like that. I have no doubt that those have been fast-tracked. But looking at the root causes of the crime and other aspects like that are not being looked at.
So I guess one thing that I don't quite understand, and perhaps you could help me with this, I mean, there seems to be general agreement on what the problems are, even on the root causes side. Would you say that was a fare assessments?
No.
No, okay.
Particularly not on that one.
Okay, could you?
Okay, I'll speak about that.
Yeah, speak about that.
From the root causes side, as I said, many of these, particularly the more vicious criminal, they're coming from depressed communities. The government is reluctant to concede this because the government is reluctant to concede that its policies are failing or that the benefits are not filtering down to everyone. And so whenever there's a claim that in these communities the crimes are coming, try to understand them, you're told that's nonsense. Because if it was poverty and discrimination, you would be getting more criminals out of the interior, for example. Because the poverty map that the government uses says that the poorest of the poor are in the rural communities. That may be so, but they're not as enlightened and as educated with things like the internet and television and newspapers as are their compatriots in the ghetto communities and the villages, the coastal villages. So the government is very reluctant, as I said, to acknowledge the linkage between crime and poverty, crime and politics. They're shying away from doing so.
Okay. But at least on the side of the police, is there some agreement on the types of things that need to be done to make the police more effective?
Undoubtedly, yes. There's no doubt about that. No doubt. I don't know if you're aware, but the two main security sector reform programs, that is the citizens, the IDB program and the DFID program. The IDB program is managed by the Ministry of Home Affairs, and the DFID program is managed by the Office of the President. So that in itself is another issue, that another situation that is creating tension. It tells of some distrust between the Office of the President and the Ministry of Home Affairs. One would have expected that the Home Affairs Ministry would have been the lead agency to oversee, to marry the two programs as best as possible and to oversee them. But that is not happening. The two seem to be, they're going along at a parallel tracks, on parallel tracks. Why, I don't know, but like I said, it tells me that there is some distrust or some tension there, even within the government. Also, because of the linkage between crime and politics, the government is very reluctant to open up to the other political stakeholders, particularly, by that I mean the opposition. Very reluctant. And so while there may be general agreement, yes, the government guards jealously its right to implement. It does not want anyone or any other group having access to too much information or a say in the implementation process, because in its eyes it will take away control. And no control means that it becomes vulnerable once again. In that, within the police force or the military, persons may, one, gain knowledge on what's happening, and two, be able to influence persons, officers within. That is a problem.
That actually answers in large part my next question, okay. I think, which was that, you know, if there is agreement, why things seem to be stalled when you have the British offering assistance and IDB offering assistance and fairly comprehensive programs on both.
But they're not, why will the government refuse? Says it wants reform.
Yeah.
Here it is that I'm providing, I agree with you, I brought in experts, I'm giving you the money for this reform, but yet you are moving at a snail's pace. Why is that? Because there's distrust and fear. But not only to opposition parties, but even to even at the international level. This is a government that felt that it was removed from office by the machinations of the British and US governments in the 1960s. It is a government that has proclaimed itself to be Marxist-Leninist. It has never overcome the fear of these countries, never underestimates the ability of the state apparatus in those two countries to manipulate the politics in this country and in other countries around the world. And to a large extent, I believe, has never forgiven those countries for doing so. And even information in the hands of a British-led team is problematic for the government, because it has developed a siege mentality that there are forces massing to remove it from office. And these forces are national and international. That is the perception. And so there's a hesitancy to respond or to open up.
So, I mean, you have these major issues surrounding the police. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've outlined many of the problems, this rising wave of crime, changing face of crime that requires a more flexible and responsive force. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the public is extremely distrustful of the police's ability to help them in situations, mm-hmm. and fearful of the police, mm-hmm. And a government that is not moving forward with the reforms that are proposed. So is there any optimism, or is there any way that you can see things moving forward? What needs to happen for these reforms to actually, for the police to effectively serve mm-hmm. the citizenry? Was that question a bit too big?
Well, I think you did an excellent job in capturing the issues. Like I said, we can't make the government move faster than it is, or in a direction, or into directions that it is not prepared to go. Trust has to be developed. And whether we accept it or not, many of the issues can only be settled or dealt with if there's a settlement of the political problems of Guyana. That, I believe, is where the solution lies. There's a lot of talk about power sharing, inclusive governance, but what you have really are, to a large extent, two nations of people being distrustful of each other. The police and the army are made up overwhelmingly of persons of African descent. The police and the army, I should tell you, at the time of voting, vote overwhelmingly for the opposition.
but yet remain loyal and professional enough to take instructions from a government that they don't vote for. Hence why the reason why there's always that tension. The voting has never been for the government.
So the government is putting a lot into gaining control of these institutions and injecting into them their own philosophy, doctrines, and turning them away from the opposition. That is why there's a reluctance to have opposition parties and others involved. And those concessions are only made when, for example, the IDB or DFID says, we are prepared to give you this money if you agree to parliamentary oversight. That is not something that the government will write on its own in designing the program. They will fight that. And they will fight the program because the end result of the program is a more open, transparent process that involves not just the government.
And that is why they're going to refuse to allow it, drag their feet. And government is very good, this government, at waging wars of attrition, frustrating you, wearing you down. So in the end, the British government is itself going to say, which is true, we can't afford to have our taxpayers' money waiting and languishing somewhere waiting for you to agree. We're going to move this money to Afghanistan or to Zimbabwe or some other place, Kenya, where the people are ready and want us to come. And the government will then say, we tried to work with them and then they'll come back and we try to redesign a new program, by which time much has been lost. But that is the strategy that they employ and deploy very effectively, frustrating you and wearing you down so that you throw up your arms in despair and disgust. But what it does, it brings them less friends, but it allows them to stay in control and in power.
As somebody who has studied things and as a grasp of sort of the theoretical problems and the regional context in which all of this is occurring, are there any other countries or areas that you look to for perhaps some inspiration or as countries that have got out of similarly difficult situations?
Well, I've looked at Trinidad and Tobago and at Trinidad and Tobago and at Jamaica, and there are some similarities, but there are very few countries, I believe, that have dealt with this problem other than through constitutional engineering. I look to Northern Ireland in particular. And I used to look at Fiji, but that continues to be very, very problematic. Suriname, to a large extent, has legislated for the different groups in the society to be represented in the state's apparatus and in the offices. But I don't think, because of course, even though Suriname is next door to us, but because they are Dutch speaking and we are English, we don't look rather to them for best practices. Though they have, to a large extent, settled many of their internal problems of crime and insecurity and violence.
Well, this has been actually extremely helpful.
It really has,
contextualizing a lot of what's going on. And I was wondering if there was anything you think I haven't asked or I should have asked. So basically, an opportunity for you to say anything, anything else on this particular issue.
I respond best to questions. And but if there's anything that you can think of that you haven't, please email me or ask, and I'll try to help as best as I can.
Okay.
I just want to put a little caveat here to say that these are my views. I don't hold myself out necessarily to be an expert, but certainly I've been involved in many of the reforms and in many of the attempts at reforming and in trying to understand what is happening and why.
Well, I think for now that's okay. Excellent, but I'm sure I'll have questions in the future, and I appreciate your willingness to answer them.
Thank you.